top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 454, the Really Awful Movies podcast, 2024's Roadhouse. I did not expect something as leisurely and lighthearted as this one. First off, I must confess, when I first encountered this, I had similar thoughts to when I came upon the announcement of the reimagining of the iconic Charles Bronson Death Wish movie by Eli Roth. And at the time, I thought, well, geez, how badly could someone potentially screw this up? And then I saw that Bruce Willis was attached to the project, and I thought, well, if you're going to launch a charm offensive, that's not a bad way to put a newfound spin on a 70s classic. This one, I think, almost goes the other way, because I must confess I'm not the biggest Jake Gyllenhaal fan. I thought he's been okay in some good movies like Zodiac and Jarhead and Donnie Darko, and he's been in a few decent projects. He played a photojournalist in Nightcrawler. He's sort of in a bunch of slightly better than okay movies, but I don't think of him as much of an actor. And actually, if anything, I think Maggie Gyllenhaal is way more capable and way more interesting. There's a certain sameness to Gyllenhaal here. And I don't think he's the one who can fill Patrick Swayze's boots for a project of this type. So right off the bat, I think while in Death Wish we got a sort of charm upgrade and a likability factor that shines from Mr. Willis, I think it sort of goes in the opposite way, because I think there was something so, I think, almost effortless and, dare I say, kind of mysterious about Patrick Swayze. And I'm by no means, I'm trying to distance myself enough from the proceedings here that I think I can safely say, and I think we can all agree on, if I may be so bold, that the original Roadhouse is not exactly, one for the ages, although it had some pretty iconic stars. I mean, I was thrilled to see Ben Gazzara, the longtime John Cassavetes player, and of course Sam Elliott as Garrett. Not to mention, as a Torontonian, it was really cool to see Jeff Healey. The Jeff Healey Band is the band that's infamously playing Behind the Wire mesh in the Double Deuce Saloon. And of course, old-timey wrestling heads will appreciate a terrible Terry Funk in the original movie. So I tried to separate myself from the original, and I lay no claim to having any kind of nostalgic love for that one, although I quite like it, and it's quite an iconic little film in its own right. And I'm trying to keep these IPs as separate as I possibly can. Now, as I said at the outset, leisurely and lighthearted, not something I would necessarily expect, but when you figure the director of this one is Paul Lyman, I believe his name is, who's the guy who gave us this kind of casual cavalier dialogue from Swingers, and is also behind Mr. and Mrs. Smith and some of the Bourne Identity movies as well. It's kind of curious, his take on this one being so travelogue heavy, if you will. I mean, this shares more in common, I think, with something like the reimagining of Miami Vice than it does with anything else. It's a really weird tack and a really strange approach to handle the source material here. And really what it boils down to is the kind of oft-cliched Western where you have the sheriff come into the town and clean things up when no one has been able to do it before, and has to ruffle a bunch of feathers and kick some ass in the process. So it's a simple film, a simple concept, a simple idea, and it's rendered in a way that is kind of, dare I say, at least for the outset, somewhat charming. There's some funny lines in it, especially about the origin of the name of the eponymous saloon, Roadhouse, which is meant to be the house beside the road, and in no ways it's supposed to be a roadhouse, if that makes any sense. Like, most roadhouses or saloons would have a, or taverns or whatever you want to call it, would actually have a name. And this is a joke that is tagged later with a boat that's been dubbed The Boat. So these kind of weird things. There's also a guy who's whittling a stick, and one of the his henchmen says, what's that going to be? And he says, well, it's going to be a smaller stick. So there is some witty banter and repartee that takes you tonally into a place that you might not otherwise expect from the original source material, which was very, very singular and very, very specific, and dealt with a specific type of backwoods redneck bar that I think people can conjure up in their imaginations if they haven't visited one themselves. This one takes us to the Florida Keys, of all places, which, from my understanding, was like a popular getaway locale and popular vacation destination for LGBT. And it strikes me as a kind of an odd, and not the first place I would think of when I would think this type of movie would take place. Not to mention the fact that the place actually doesn't look like it would harbor these kinds of drunken punch-em-out denizens as it does. I mean, it's sort of an A-frame type structure. It looks almost, at least in daylight, kind of like a classy beach bar, whereas the Double Deuce in the original looks like a real dump in someplace you'd be, whose door you would not want to darken for fear of getting the shit knocked out of you. Like, I can't say at all that I'm really particularly familiar with bar brawls. Like, I've been separated when someone has attacked me in one, and I've been tossed from a couple of some of our finer establishments in Toronto, but that's mostly for smoking weed. But I think anyone who's been a drinker or still is, and who's palmed a few pints at some establishments that are, shall we say, less than savory, can sort of grasp that when there is a certain menace to a place, it's almost like something is in the air. And I remember I was at a place like about 10 minutes south of here, and it's just one of these dives that has music every night, and above it they had this, I guess this kind of boutique hotel kind of space. And I remember sitting there with a friend watching this sort of lounge act, and I looked over at another table, and a guy had stepped up and reached across the table, knocked over his glass, and slugged his companion. It was really, really weird. I've seen a few bar fights whose genesis were a little bit mysterious and odd. But what's definitely something that doesn't happen is that the whole place just participates. It's almost the cliche of the Western. When someone throws a punch, everyone dives in, and then chairs are broken over backs, and that's the type of thing that never really happens. Like, if anything, maybe some friends will jump in, but for the most part, the cooler heads prevail and people scatter, and discretion is the and valor and all that and whatnot. So seldom is it that you'll have a 20 to 30 to 40 people involved in some battle royale Donnybrook. It just doesn't happen. But anyway, what we have here is sort of like a note for note, beat for beat retread of the original, except with a bunch of very, very like lighthearted and very, very casual and very spirited repartee, and a lot of investment in sort of secondary characters. In one instance, a small independent bookshop owner run by the proprietor's daughter, who's very friendly and engaging with Key West tourists, and hands out pamphlets and gives a little backstory about lore and talk. And there's little vignettes about how crocodiles hide their food, and then there's some instances of just little references and banter, and how you dream when you sleep out on the water. And there's sort of more thought that went into this than certainly the original film. And I'm trying to process as I'm extemporaneously going through this whether that serves this one in good stead. I think it does, but it depends what kind of movie you're expecting from this. So if I may be so bold as to say what I would have done had I been bankrolling this one or a part of the creative team behind a reimagining of this 1989 iconic IP. I think it would have been, beholden upon producers and creatives to maybe uproot the setting and take things to a place that is most known for this kind of a bouncer and a lunkhead culture. And I can't think of a better place, frankly, than I think Northern England. I think that would have been really to take this production, decamp it, remove it from its white trash and shit-kicking cowboy roots and put it in the north. North of the UK, and I was kind of thinking this would be interesting because there's a documentary that sort of inspired my line of thinking called Bouncers Behind the Velvet Rope, and it tells the tale of this roughhouse East End London bouncers like Lenny McLean, I think that's his name, and others who are around at this time, and there's a lot of like badass Cockney accents and like right out of a Guy Ritchie kind of badass film. All these guys were the real life incarnations of those guys, and there's a certain menace and a certain seediness and a certain culture and hard drinking, hard living culture that I think could really be replicated in some of the more like industrial parts of the north of England. And I think that would have been maybe if you had taken it to Manchester, I think this could have lived in a different jurisdiction. Although fair play to them that I think, you know, a southern shit kicker saloon and roadhouse in the original was obviously a very, very good point of reference and has, I think, resonance beyond people who might have actually visited such places, especially when you populate it with kinds of biker degenerate stereotypes who would actually frequent one of these places and who would start battles and start talking shit. The closest we have in my neck of the woods would certainly not be in Toronto, where roughhousing isn't totally common, although I've seen my share of bar fights, but it's not something that's a common occurrence by any means. But I think if you go 3 to 4 hours north of here into small town Ontario, and I think more like bare knuckle hockey culture and that kind of meathead mentality, I think you could definitely find some of this sort of simpleton, swing first, ask questions later, sort of a belligerence. I think you could definitely find it. I think you could find it probably in a small town, Alberta as well. And I think these would be sort of locales where you could do that. I think in rural Washington State, I think you could do this. Alaska, you could do this. There's certain pockets of, I think, where this kind of thing would have resonated if you were to take it out of its home base, if you will. Now, I was sort of also surprised by the level of diversity and multiculturalism of this one, but sort of appreciative of the fact that there wasn't any sort of heavy-handed sort of racial messaging that, you know, is going to, you know, hammer you over the head like a bar stool or something. It was, I think, reflective of what this part of Florida is now, and I think it didn't neither added nor detracted from things. And the really only way it manifested itself was through some of the fringe characters, and particularly the bar owner, who's not a fringe character, but this Frankie woman, who's an African American, who's the lone holdout against this, of course, evil developer, who's the modern incarnate of the Ben Gazzara character from the first movie. But I also think when you see the band, or the bands, I should say, there's lots behind that chicken wire. You have like a reggae band, you have a Zydeco band with a guy playing that sort of the chest breastplate. I think it's called a rub board. It's like a percussion instrument. There's a blues band, rock bands, and it was certainly kind of interesting because there's no particular specific clientele that this place attracts. Like, it just attracts sort of a multi-ethnic, multi-racial crowd of like a lot of douchebags, but no, and some bikers too, and which our hero Dalton, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, makes quick work of at the beginning with some quips right out of the 80s action handbook. But it's sort of interesting that this place is kind of an anywhere and any one kind of aesthetic, taking it away from what happened in the first movie. And it should also be said that this is the third Roadhouse movie, and I have not seen Roadhouse 2 Last Call, which is, I think, a DTV, direct-to-video, throwaway 90s effort, if I'm not mistaken, but I haven't had a chance to engage with that one. Now, this is a weird one because right off the bat, you get a sense of the Dalton character's dealings with professional fighting. And that's something that puts this one in a slightly different category as well than the first movie, because Gyllenhaal is an ex-UFC fighter and has gone down a peg after seriously injuring an opponent and presumably cut from the UFC. And you actually do get to see some footage of, I think it's Bruce Buffer. And he makes an appearance here, and the whole backstory is that Dalton, the expert bouncer who's conscripted by the new Roadhouse owner to help clean the place up, he seriously injured someone in a UFC fight, which is, as an aside, kind of bizarre too, because most of the serious mishaps and accidents have occurred in boxing and not the UFC. Like, more deaths happen in boxing. And at the beginning, when you see he's fallen down a peg, because he's no longer a professional fighter in the true sense, but one who goes to these more like underground circuit type places, you see him battle, or it was about to battle Post Malone playing Carter. And Post Malone, is his sheer ubiquity, whether it's, you know, playing at the Super Bowl or rapping or singing or everything, he's just such a presence all over the place. And he plays this grizzled underground cage fighter who quakes in his boots at the sight of this Dalton character. And that gave me a little bit of a laugh at the outset. Because basically Dalton was paid off without having to fight because the guy was so intimidated, which is kind of crazy. I mean, if you want to go into fighting lore, and I'm a fan of both UFC and boxing, like, it was all too common for different fighters, regardless of the era, and it happens to this day, to duck fighters who they know or can get a sense or going to give them a stern ass whooping. But to actually have it happen in the octagon or in the ring is preposterous and would never happen. So it is kind of silly. I mean, there's a long story tradition going back 100 years of fighters who are artificially boosting their record by avoiding some of the more badasses of the sport. And you can go all the way back to Jack Johnson and Jack Dempsey and all those heavyweights from the golden era and beyond in boxing up to the modern day. But it's just so hilarious that this Carter character, this grizzled guy who you see in the first 5 minutes beating the holy tar out of this other giant guy, and then resolutely avoiding Dalton as we get the iconic neon signage of Roadhouse across the screen, is sort of an absurdity. But I think it's kind of an interesting idea, if not really handled in the best way. But again, you have to add a little bit to what is essentially not much of a story at the outset, but more of a Western with just a sheriff, whipping people into shape. And to that end, in the UFC connection as well, I'm sure many of our listeners would be no doubt aware that the notorious one, Conor McGregor, is in this one as well, playing Knox, who's this sort of henchman of this evil developer character named Brandt, who owns land up and down the seaboard, and is basically trying to do his dirty work. In one instance, we're going to segue here into what we learned, saying he always likes to go clubbing as he clutches a driver, a golf club in his hand, and proceeds to make his way to the Roadhouse. And he seems just absolutely coked, if not just roided out of his bloody mind. And it's something I thought of when I think after the Dustin Poirier and of course the Khabib and Nurmagomedov fights, after he'd lost a few bouts, he seemingly, I think, turned to the juice and is a bit unhinged ever since. And I don't know what's up with that guy, but if I were to be in a death pool, I would certainly put him in it, and he would certainly pay out as a guy who's in his 30s. But anyway, as much as Gyllenhaal is miscast, I think the casting of McGregor is quite good, even if he does reference his own nickname and handle in the UFC, the Notorious One, when he refers to Dalton, which is a little bit cheesy and a little bit off-putting. And speaking of references to other things, like I mentioned, the Eli Roth death wish. Well, one of the corrupt cops in whose pocket Brandt has been depositing lots of bribes, he asks the Dalton hero, "Do you have a death wish, son?" And then it all came full circle as I was thinking. That was sort of my jumping off point for how I would engage with this movie. And again, Death Wish versus this one. I think obviously Death Wish is such an iconic property of the 70s and so gritty and so jarring and asks you so many tough moral and ethical questions in a way that obviously Roadhouse does not. So they had far further to fall with the Death Wish reimagining. And this one, I think you could give more of a pass to because the original wasn't exactly some sort of groundbreaking work of cinematic excellence that'll stand the test of time. And there are a few more things I've learned here. There's, I believe it's Daniela Melchior, who plays this local doctor, again, referencing the first movie, who becomes the romantic interest of Dalton, and they connect. And, you know, she treats some of the goons that he's beaten the holy tar out of. And there's some good repartee between them. And so they have a fun little date out on the beach. And again, this is really a gorgeous movie in a way that I didn't expect a movie called Roadhouse would be. I mean, just the amazing beachfront vistas. It really does serve as like Expedia couldn't even do it better than this. This is just pure travelog, travel porn style film. It's criminally overlong, but it gives us these visuals that you can't help but knock it, because you could just, especially if you're in these parts and you're in the dead of winter, you can't help but to turn your eyes to this locale and just go, geez, if I were there right now. And there is, because it's the Keys, there's a reference to Hemingway and how he frequented a certain, I think he might have even frequented the roadhouse in question here. And there's banter discussing this and whether this Dalton character actually understands the reference that Frankie is making. And I did wonder where this thing was going at the outset, when you have this African-American bar owner frequenting this, off the grid fighting tournament, and wondering what the hell I was getting myself into. But I'm glad I did get myself into this, because it's just easy breezy time waster fodder, easy casual viewing. It's not going to break new ground on anything. It's not going to offend. It's not meant to provoke. It just is what it is. Simple, straightforward storytelling with some good characterization, some good charming spirited dialogue. A solid 3 out of 5 for me on this one. And I'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Action movies rule. It's because when action directors yell action, they really mean it. There's action. If you're a fan of ass-kicking action films,
you and me, we know so different.
Whether it's the absolutely thrilling one-liners.
Hey, here's a quarter. Buy yourself a personality.
You're a funny guy, Sally. That's why I'm going to kill you last.
The interesting gender politics.
Believe that all the crimes have been committed by a lone assailant. There's a high probability that assailant is a woman.
And the even more interesting plot lines.
An army of international terrorists has landed. Only one man stands in their way.
They're always wickedly entertaining. If you love action movies like we do, you'll love our book, Mine's Bigger Than Yours, the 100 Wackiest Action Movies.
Come on, punk!
Oh, I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right?
Buy a copy, and we won't be forced to commandeer a chopper and hunt you down with a bunch of ex-Special Forces ops. Thanks.
Thank you.